The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Could Europe, that has struggled with economic division, suddenly become once again a place of checkpoints and border frontiers and razor wire barriers? Donald Trump certainly didn't invent walls as a way to keep people out. The Berlin Wall fell back in 1989, ending the Cold War. Could a wall between Munich, Germany, and Salzburg, Austria, go up in 2015? Germany closed its border briefly to stop a flood of refugee immigrants from the Middle East it estimates will grow to more than a million by the end of the year. European ministers are meeting in Brussels today to divide up the mere 160,000 refugees most in need and are stuck on the issue of mandatory quotas for individual countries. Hungary has put in place barbed wire barriers at some of its border crossings with Serbia. For decades, there has been no passport requirement for travel from country to country in the Eurozone, the so-called Schengen Convention. Could all of this be threatened? First, the view from Germany. Jan van Aken is a left party member of the Bundestag who serves on the German Foreign Affairs Committee. He says the scale of the migration has put many political passions in play at once. He's optimistic, he says, but calls it a fragile situation in his country and around Europe as a whole.
The general mood in Germany really shifted in the past couple of weeks. While in July we still had sort of the major news was attacks on immigrants, attacks on asylum seeker houses. Now the major news is that there's an incredible wave of help for immigrants. And I think that now that the majority of the Germans are in favor of more immigrants, which is really new for Germans, which never had been said that they are living in an immigrant country.
What do Germans think that millions of people want to come there? Certainly, 50, 60, 70 years ago, Germany was the last place many people wanted to go. Times have really, really changed in world history.
Yes. I mean, there's two things in German history that play into today's mood. One is that during Nazi times, many, many people, Jews, communists, whatever, had to flee, and they had a very hard time to find other countries to take them up. This shaped post-war laws in Germany, so we have this asylum-seeking law. The other thing that happened is that after the war, we had millions of people who fled from the Red Army, from the Soviet Union towards Germany. So there were a couple of million people overnight, basically, arriving in post-war Germany. And so many people, like my mother, like many other family members, have this experience. They have been refugees 50 years ago, 60 years ago. And so I think these two things come together now that this is one of the reasons why the majority of the people are now welcoming the refugees.
What is the sense that some of the faces that you're seeing showing up on your doorstep in Munich are really the responsibility of the United States that began a process of destabilization in the region, which may have begun in 2003, but has led us to this moment?
Sure. The U.S. were part of the problem. I'm not the one to say that the U.S. is the only one to blame. Not at all. I mean, there are players in the region that were in our problem, Assad being only one, or Saddam Hussein. There are also figures and politicians in Europe that were a problem. And I was furious last year when I heard that the German government wanted to take up only 5,000 Syrian refugees, 5,000. While in Jordan, there was already more than a million, and Turkey was more than a million. So it was also the Western politicians that were part of the problem, but it's right. I mean, without the illegal aggression in 2003 against Iraq, we would have much less of a problem today.
I don't know where you stand on Pope Francis, but he has said that this is the tip of the iceberg, that essentially capitalist European countries and the West in general can expect this to increase exponentially over the course of this century, and that from his perspective at the Vatican, no one's prepared for it.
I think on this point, he's absolutely right. And I think even German politicians, the German parliament, or all over Europe, nobody realizes that what we are seeing today is normality. Everybody thinks this is a crisis, this is exceptional, But I think it's right that we will see these kind of numbers over the next couple of years. And there's no way that you can put up walls, fences, or whatever kind of protection. These people flee from war, and they take all the risks. So they will arrive here. So we have to plan for the next couple of years that every year we will have 1 million immigrants.
What frustrates you most about Angela Merkel's position on this and the Christian Democrats in general?
I mean, Angela Merkel is usually the most progressive within her party. She was the one who ordered last week to open the borders and let them in. And most members of her party were furious about it because the conservatives, the Christian Democrats, they are anti-immigrant. They don't want the refugees here, or only the good ones, you know, the well-trained ones, the young ones. If they are fluent in German and if they are doctors, they are welcome. But all the others, they don't want to see here. So I think it's some of the very top politicians of the Christian Democratic Union, especially the Bavarian ones, that are really feeding and fueling a rage on the right-wing side in Germany. It's dangerous.
And this rage, what scares you most about it? I mean, there's certainly a sense of xenophobia in places and pockets of Europe and the United States that can have some very, very ugly consequences.
I mean, we had this very ugly phase of Germany in the 90s when people were killed, you know, when asylum seekers' houses were burned down, when there was a lot of aggression. It started in July like this, and I was afraid that we would see the same scenes like in the 90s now in Germany. And then it shifted. Just over the last couple of 4 or 5 weeks, it shifted totally towards the other extreme, like everybody tries to help the refugees. But I think it can take, you know, just a couple of remarks from one of these top politicians, some incidents, and then it can go back. I'm afraid that we will see quite some violence against asylum seekers. And I mean, there were a couple of arson attacks already. So it's dangerous, yes.
Jan van Aken is a German member of parliament for the Left Party. He serves on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the German Bundestag and spoke to us from Hamburg. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
A voice now from the other side of the German-Austrian frontier. Ooh, that's an eerie way to speak about what has been an open border for decades. She would not call the Austrian-German border a frontier, but Simona Artner, a reporter at Kronehit Radio, an Austrian radio station, says Germany's decision to temporarily shut the rail link between Salzburg and Munich produced a very unsettling chaos that's still continuing.
Well, at the moment, nobody knows what you need to have to travel around. Actually, fact is that Germany decided to have border controls again, so you can't go there without an ID. The tragic thing is that most refugees don't have IDs.
And so that would require processing on the Austrian side of the border. In practical terms, what does that mean at this point?
Well, there is no registration in Austria, as far as I know right now, because we just take care of the refugees. We are still trying that they can go wherever they want to go, in most cases Germany. Our Minister of the Interior is trying to say stop, also like Germany did. It's a difficult situation right now.
One has not envisioned refugee camps in the territory of Austria since the end of World War II. In terms of population mobilization and the movements of people that took place after 1945, suddenly there's an infrastructure that is needed, that hasn't been needed for decades.
Well, there is still the hope that the other European countries are doing what they have to do and that refugees can go there too. At the moment, Austria and Germany are carrying the biggest part of the whole thing, but I think there has to be a solution within the next weeks that other European countries are taking refugees too.
Simona Artner is a reporter at Kronehit Radio, an Austrian national radio station. Thank you so much, Simona.
Thank you, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from American Experience on PBS, presenting Walt Disney, featuring footage from the Disney archive and interviews with those who worked on his films. Walt Disney showcases the complex life and enduring legacy of one of America's most influential storytellers. A two-night event beginning Monday at 9, 8 Central on PBS. And LegalZoom, offering resources to help ensure the last wishes of individuals are upheld through last wills, living trusts, and powers of attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Russia has reportedly been aggressively rearming the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad with flagrant air supply missions over Iraq and Syria in the past week. Those missions have been condemned by the U.S., as well as an apparent buildup of Russian military materiel in the Syrian city of Latakia, all that reported by our partner, the New York Times. And all this in advance of Russia taking over leadership of the United Nations Security Council this month, a Security Council stymied by Russian vetoes of resolutions attempting to stop the conflict in Syria. Karen Ross, former British diplomat, joins us now. Is this something that would be expected by Russia's President Putin to rattle the saber as Russia takes over the Security Council, or would this be just coincidence?
It's coincidence. I mean, Russia taking over the Security Council is merely a function of its place in the alphabet rather than any broader geopolitical significance. But the Putin's move in Syria seems to be more connected with asserting Russian influence in Syria, perhaps through the shifting dynamics of Iran's role, the U.S. role, greater U.S. interest in a no-fly zone, et cetera, et cetera.
And is there anything that Russia can do in the Security Council as leader of it that it wouldn't have been able to do with its veto power in the past?
No, it's easy to overestimate the importance of the Security Council presidency. It's more a technical role than a political role, though it does give you the power to control drafts when votes are taken, but it doesn't allow you to get decisions through the Security Council that you otherwise would not be able to.
There's been a broader discussion of how the United Nations in its conflict resolution function has been stymied continually, really since 2003, the invasion of Iraq, and accelerated with Russia's recent veto of the resolution talking about the massacre at Srebrenica in Bosnia. Is the conflict resolution Security Council function of the United Nations really in trouble right now compared with the humanitarian function of the UN, which seems to be working much, much more effectively on the ground?
The Security Council is only effective when the members of the Permanent Five agree on things. It's a kind of obvious thing to say, but it's an eternal truth of the Security Council. And over certain and the most important conflicts, in particular Syria, of course, the P5 and the Russians and the Americans in particular don't agree. So when that happens, the Security Council is not effective. It's not able to make decisions and it's not able to agree minimum steps such as an arms embargo on the regime, sanctions on the regime that is killing the most civilians, elementary measures to protect civilians in Syria. That's not happening.
Let's look at the deal with Iran that was negotiated by a group of nations, some in the Security Council, some not in the Security Council, and is also taking place outside of the normal channels of treaty ratification. Here in the United States, it's not even considered a treaty. It would seem that the diplomatic wheels are turning in very, very different ways in this century than we're accustomed to in the last century.
I don't know that that's true. I mean, what's extraordinary about the situation is, although we're facing turmoil and conflict all over the world, the major powers still see the United Nations and the Security Council as a place to discuss these crises and where they can agree action upon them. The Iran deal is somewhat sui generis. I think it's somewhat out of the mainstream of normal diplomatic business, partly because of the unique nature of the problem. In a sense, it's not really a formal diplomatic instrument like a treaty, which is multilateral, which involves many, if not all, states of the United Nations. It's only a small subgroup of states. So in that sense, it's unusual.
But can I press you on that? I mean, it would seem as though the same is true in North Korea, that the Security Council is not very effective in North Korea, and there are nations that are dealing independently with North Korea, and that we can't necessarily rely on the Security Council in that conflict. And NATO, of course, is as important as the United Nations as a peacekeeping function, and some would even dispute that.
Small group diplomacy has always been important, particularly in dealing with some of the most contentious and difficult issues. In the war in Yugoslavia, you had a small group of countries called the Contact Group, which tried to arbitrate the diplomacy and find a way forward in that conflict. Iran and indeed North Korea is similar. The UN Security Council is a pretty unwieldy body, even though it's 15 countries. Some of those countries are not, frankly, very important diplomatically. And it makes sense for smaller groups to try to thrash things out in private together. So, you know, for me, it's horses for courses. What is the best model? What is the best form of diplomacy to address a particular issue? And usually that means getting together the countries with the most at stake in that issue. I don't love it because often it leads to very private, secretive, and therefore not necessarily effective diplomacy. I always prefer more transparency and more inclusion of those most affected.
Would reform of the Security Council process bring that kind of transparency, or should we just sort of let it kind of muddle on?
Well, it will muddle on because I'm afraid reform is unlikely as long as the permanent five veto-wielding members don't want it, and they don't particularly, despite protestations to the contrary by the Europeans in particular. But there are some reforms that actually are simple and don't require expansion of the membership or change to the veto. For instance, just making sure that the parties who are involved in a conflict are invited to address the Security Council whenever they discuss that conflict seems like a very basic, simple, and obvious thing to do, but I'm afraid it doesn't happen.
Let's go back to Putin for just one moment before we say goodbye to you. Karen Ross, do you think that Putin can accelerate his attempts to support the Syrian regime in Damascus at the same time as he maintains a war footing in Ukraine?
Well, the war in Ukraine seems, at the moment at least, to be dying down. What the Russians are up to in Syria is not entirely clear, but the Russians can't win the war for the regime. The Assad regime does not have the forces or the military effectiveness to control territory in Syria. And even if the Russians give them lots of air support, wars cannot be won solely from the air. So I don't see the Russian intervention in Syria as a game changer. And I think the thing that would change the game, however, is if the US and the West in general were to think about and set up a deterrent no-fly zone over Syria, which would, I think, change the calculations of the Syrian regime and force them at last to the table.
And get Putin's attention. Putin, who takes over leadership of the Security Council this month. Karen Ross, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like marketing, meditation, and metalworking. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
The 1995 Beijing Declaration of Rights for Women does not talk about fashion, appearance, or the ways in which women feel they must maintain a youthful, sexually appealing image to succeed in the modern workplace. But provision number 5 in the Beijing Declaration says that inequalities between women and men have persisted and major obstacles remain. That is about as close as it gets to talking about concrete things like cosmetics, makeup, the estimated yearly cost, $15,000, and time, 2 weeks a year, women must spend to meet a socially accepted standard of appearance. There are other major obstacles to gender equality, of course, but we gave one of our women interns the assignment to go out and experience this unequal makeup tax effect herself.
Hi, my name is Cheyenne Hazlett. I'm an intern here at The Takeaway. Like a lot of people my age, on the weekends, I'm a waitress. Let's see, I'm tall, I'm confident on a good day, I'm something of an athlete, definitely not a morning person. And this may be why I don't really wear makeup. Never have. I don't make a point not to wear makeup. I've just never seen a big difference for the amount of time I'm willing to put into it, and never felt infinitely more confident in it. So I realized when we were discussing this segment last week, I was actually in a position to test some of these numbers, makeup versus no makeup. One study found waitresses made more tips when they were wearing makeup. Really? I mean, I could find out. So I decided I would leave my secure, barefaced world and venture into the wilderness of cosmetics to see if there truly was this alleged makeup bonus. I would need some help. At Blue Mercury, this makeup place I've walked past all my life, I set up an appointment with makeup artist Narges, and she went to work. As she applied the third shade of eyeshadow, I wanted to know if she would ever go barefaced. What if I refunded her the makeup tax? The $15,000 in up to 2 weeks a year.
No, I have to wear it. Doesn't matter. I think the price is not what I'm looking for. I think what you're looking for is how it makes you feel. And I don't think you can price anything like that.
Any other takers? Well, not Taryn, in the next chair.
The reason to wear makeup is that it makes you feel like yourself at your best. It's not really meant to change anything, except for how you perceive yourself. And how you perceive yourself changes so much about your self-confidence that it changes the way that other people perceive you.
So makeup artist Taryn says it's about confidence. Narges says it's a priceless feeling. How about me? My only feeling at this point was awkward. It took an hour to go from barefaced Cheyenne to this evenly toned, dark-lashed, full-browed, wide-eyed, done-up me.
What do you think?
I don't know. You know, it always takes me a second when I look at myself in makeup to think, do I love the way this looks, or do I just feel like I'm wearing a ton of makeup right now? I was polite, but still uncertain. By the time I get to the restaurant, I'm starting to watch for people's reactions. I'm sort of excited, like I was in a brand new outfit, but the eyeliner was making my eyes water. As I settled in for my shift, I felt overdressed. I've been coming to this place for months, and suddenly it's like I'm wearing a prom dress. Am I trying too hard? Am I too done up? But the attention did feel good. Everyone noticed, and it was cool. Another waitress got choked up, did a, aw, my little girl, all grown up kind of thing. I hear the word fab. A guy friend, quietly, almost concerned, pulled me aside and asks, what's with the makeup? I did something that usually got me a scolding from the chef, and instead, he left me alone. It was the makeup, joked the food runner. People are noticing. I walked up to my first table with a huge smile on my face, exuberant, confident, cheerful, laughing, highly energized, chatting with the guests. Table for two, 32% tip. Nice. By the end of the night, I was ahead of my barefaced shift from last week, 22% to 20%. But it wasn't the money. More tangible was the feeling. I had somehow bought confidence, makeup as this confidence I could wear. Even so, at the end of the night, I was thrilled to go home and wipe it all off. That look wasn't me. But I learned something. Makeup works. How much power it has is up to each person to decide. It gave me confidence in this instance, a confidence that cost an hour of my time and about $50. So was the makeup bonus worth it? I'm going to have to think about that.
Cheyenne Hazlett is a Takeaway intern reporting from Westport, Connecticut.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
It's been 20 years since women leaders in the world gathered in Beijing, China, to hammer out a Universal Declaration of Women's Rights.
We must elect more women. Yes. I mean, we're only 10% in the parliaments of the world.
There's the voice of a leader from the United States, no longer with us, feminist congresswoman and New York legend Bella Abzug. Pakistan's Benazir Bhutto was a voice for gender equality back then. She was assassinated in 2007. Today, this woman is a presidential candidate and former U.S. Secretary of State. But 20 years ago, she held the ceremonial title of First Lady to President Bill Clinton. But that didn't stop Hillary Clinton from making a very famous speech in Beijing.
I believe that now, on the eve of a new millennium, it is time to break the silence. It is time for us to say here in Beijing and for the world to hear that it is no longer acceptable to discuss women's rights as separate from human rights.
20 years ago, Samantha Power was a 24-year-old journalist who had developed a jaded view of the ability of nations to protect human rights, male or female. She had just returned from Sarajevo covering the Bosnian War, observing firsthand the effects of genocide. Today, Samantha Power is the United States ambassador to the United Nations, serving President Barack Obama. Under Ambassador Power, the U.S. mission to the U.N. is remembering the 20th anniversary of the Beijing conference with an exhibit called Free the 20. Ambassador Power showed us the photographic display that features 20 women, political prisoners, detained around the world.
Every day we have all the diplomats of the world entering the building across the street, which is the United Nations. There's the Security Council, which we can see from here, and the back of the General Assembly. And most of the time, as they, you know, march down the street, they're looking at their Blackberries, or on a good day, they're looking at the flags and thinking about the majesty and possibility for world peace. But what they're often not doing is thinking about individuals. And so what we decided to do is, just instead of just launching a campaign called Free the 20, we decided to take advantage of this wide open space that we have here, a large facade to the U.S. mission, and to actually hang the portraits of the 20 women one by one as we profiled them, so that diplomats from these countries, you know, would see that this was something we were taking very seriously. We're using the premises of the U.S. mission like this for the first time.
Beyond the diplomats, what if a young girl came by and happened to ask you, why are these pictures up here? What would you tell her?
Well, I'm trying to have that conversation with my daughter, who's maybe a little young for it right now. But, these are the heroes of our time. We have a way of, thinking about people like Nelson Mandela or Václav Havel. But there are women in the here and now who are risking everything and who are not able to be with their sons and daughters or with their parents because they stood up for what they believed in, because it mattered more to them to try to improve their communities than to look out for themselves. And that's a pretty amazing message for young girls in this country and young girls in any country to hear. And I also, it matters a great deal to me that these women and their families know that America hasn't forgotten about them, and that they're on our minds, and that we are going to continue to raise these cases for as long as they are languishing in prison.
To see pictures of the Free the 20 campaign, head over to thetakeaway.org, and we'll hear more of my conversation with Ambassador Power later this hour. On a spectacular summer day on the busy streets across from the United Nations headquarters in New York City, Samantha Power, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, is one of the most powerful women in the Obama administration. And she herself is a sign of progress in addressing gender equality and giving women more of a role in political leadership around the world. Seeking equality and leadership for women was the global mission of the Beijing Conference 20 years ago. Under the auspices of the United Nations, a human rights declaration for women was outlined in a set of goals that challenged morality, sexual norms, and some deeply held traditions in many cultures. Today, those issues of human rights being tested most urgently involve the fate of millions of refugees leaving the Middle East and Africa, bound for Europe and even the United States. Whose responsibility is it to safeguard the rights of these people, most of whom are women and children? Ambassador Samantha Power spoke with us in a wide-ranging conversation that addressed the strengths and weaknesses of the United Nations 20 years after the 1995 Beijing conference.
When I think about the privileged positions that we get to occupy here in this country, and then contrast doing that in a society like this one with any one of these societies in which these women are taking these risks, I mean, it's unbelievable. We have one woman here on the list, Gao Yu, who was arrested back in 1989 in the Tiananmen Square protests, spent a year in prison, and then 25 years later, around the anniversary of Tiananmen, gathered with a bunch of activists to think about how they were going to commemorate it, and then was arrested again. And she's one of the women that we're profiling. And in the intervening 25 years, she continued to write and speak out, even knowing what the consequences would be for her and for her family.
It's Beijing plus 20. Has China made progress on this front and others, particularly in the advocacy that this woman you just spoke of is crying out for?
Well, China will be hosting this conference. President Xi is coming to the General Assembly for the first time. And also, as you know, will be coming to Washington. Human rights is going to be a very big topic in his meeting with President Obama. There's an amazing story to tell about Chinese development and the development of men and women alike in terms of economic empowerment. But it's a very difficult time right now because the government is cracking down in quite dramatic ways against NGOs. And we're living in a year, just in the run-up to this Beijing Plus 20 conference, where women who advocated against sexual harassment and on behalf of women's rights themselves were locked up.
We're speaking on a hustling, bustling, beautiful summer day here in New York, right outside the United Nations. And to think broadly about the world, UNICEF and the High Commission says that there are 60 million displaced persons in the world because of conflict, and most of them are women and children. How does Beijing Plus 20 address the faces of those refugees and migrants who are so much in the news right now?
Well, I think what you'll see at the coming General Assembly, which is the 70th anniversary of the United Nations, and you'll see a lot of angst, I think, about the United Nations, some celebration of some recent advances, and a kind of schizophrenia, really, about whether we have the tools and have mobilized the resources to get the job done in 2015. So on the one hand, you have
a remarkable success story on Ebola. We have the Iran deal, which is an emblem of the Security Council coming together, putting in place tough sanctions, and then us going to the negotiating table and securing the terms we need to dismantle Iran's nuclear program. And then on the other, you have these scenes, almost biblical scenes, of people being displaced. So we have our work cut out for us right now. The needs of these desperate families are far outpacing what governments have been able to mobilize. To take Syria as an example, the United States has given $4.1 billion. It's an enormous amount of money and resources and a symptom of the generosity of the American people. And yet we're only scratching the surface.
Since you mentioned Syria, John Kerry's predecessor as Secretary of State, or one of his predecessors as Secretary of State, he said, if you break it, you own it. Is it a fair argument to say that many of the faces coming out of the Middle East in Iraq and Syria are owned by some of the missteps of the United States in 2003, and that we need to accept that ownership and maybe even go beyond the 10,000 refugees that the administration said we will welcome to the United States this week?
The United States got a very slow start in admitting Iraqi refugees in the wake of the Iraq War, when there was the first wave of massive displacement into the neighboring countries. And in the tail end of the Bush administration and the beginning of the Obama administration, again, credit to the American people, we have opened our doors to Iraqi refugees and managed over time to dramatically increase the numbers that are coming here. On Syria, the numbers are quite modest given the needs. And President Obama has been very clear that, again, this General Assembly, we need to use this occasion to see if we can sort of mobilize a means of sharing what is a burden that no one country, even a country as large and often as generous as the United States, a burden that we alone aren't going to be able to bear. So it's going to have to be comprehensive, and there's no question that, it's almost impossible to find words to convey how urgent it is to bring more hands on deck. And a year from now, we need to look back and see that we've done a much better job catering to the needs of these innocent families who wanted nothing more than to have rights and you know, see their dignity respected, and have been greeted, unfortunately, by Assad with barrel bombs and gas, and by ISIL, again, with a kind of brutality that, is unspeakable.
You've observed the UN at a particularly interesting moment. When I grew up in high school, we were always taught that the Security Council was kind of the main event and everything else was sort of window dressing. Mm-hmm. Certainly it was important. UNICEF was something you did at Halloween. And as I began my journalism career, the Security Council really was the main event news-wise, and things like the Millennium Development Goals seemed certainly very well-intentioned, but not the big headline. It's almost as though that's reversed, because the successes on the humanitarian side in some ways underscore just how frustrated the Security Council has been in conflict resolution. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I think it's a profound point you make. I would say that there is a recognition of the interlinkages across the development, the human rights, and the security and conflict resolution space. I mean, if you take climate change, a catastrophic occurrence in its own right because of what it is doing to nature, but if you look at it in the context of scarcity and desertification and see how much of a factor it's becoming also in shrinking resources, which in turn are giving rise to conflict, you'll see that what we do in the Security Council is ever more linked with the humanitarian and the development issues being addressed elsewhere in the UN system. So I think intellectually and normatively, people have made progress and they've started to bring these strands together, recognizing that there's only so much. You can send 130,000 peacekeepers out into harm's way, but they're there to kind of put the finger in the dike until somebody figures out how to deal with the root causes of conflict, you know, and brings a political settlement to bear. And political settlements themselves are rooted in resources and competition for resources and territory and so forth. So, everything is related to everything else, but resourcing the solutions and ending a kind of free rider problem that also persists at an organization like this one. So changing the incentive structures so that countries are prepared to invest here in those solutions, that's the next phase of this, now that we've got the intellectual understanding that everything's related to everything else.
Ambassador Power, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Samantha Power is the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. To see the faces of the 20 women political prisoners in the Free the 20 campaign, just go to thetakeaway.org. That's all for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.